This is Climate Game Changers. I'm John Dankosky. This program is a collaboration between Connecticut Public Radio and the Nature Conservancy. I moderated this panel discussion about our changing climate, the ways we're adapting, and what communities can do at Croon Hall. It's the home to Yale's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Later in this hour, we'll hear about what our region can learn from Kansas about renewable energy and about how the city of Boston is adapting to rapidly rising seas. But let's start on stage with Gary Yeo. I've been talking with Gary about climate change for more than a decade, and nobody understands the impacts better. He's a professor of economics at Wesleyan University. He won the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize as part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Climate change is here. It's happening in all 50 states. People have observed it in all 50 states, even Oklahoma. They recognize that outside their window, they have noticed that the climate has changed. They're coming to recognize that humans are to blame for the warming, and therefore coming to recognize that humans can help ameliorate the risks and reduce the pace of emissions. Used to be that climate was ranked in priorities pretty low on what people thought about when they go to the polling place, but these days it's not jobs and it's not the economy just yet, but it's about third. And across the 50 states, the majority of the people that live there feel like I just said.
Joining Gary Yeo on stage was author and environmental activist Bill McKibben. He started 350.org as a grassroots climate action organization. For as many years as he's been at it, he told us there's still tension between climate activists working to adapt to these changes and those who are focused on mitigation.
The one thing to be said is that if we don't figure out how to dramatically slow how fast the temperature rises, we're going to reach a point for which adaptation is not useful. I mean, there's a point at which the impacts are so large. And so I think the correct mantra is adapt to that which you can't prevent, prevent that to which you can't adapt. And I think at the moment, that means that really they're often the same strategy. I mean, the single best adaptation strategy, in a sense, is to quickly limit just how warm it's going to get. But just to sort of understand that, I mean, New York City is spending $10, $12 billion building a wall that covers part of lower Manhattan, a sort of ocean surge barrier. It's designed to protect against a couple of feet of more sea level rise. If we keep warming on the trajectory we're now on, well, there's not a wall high enough that you could build to get the job done. So these things together are really important.
Here in Connecticut, cities and towns are dealing with the issues of climate change on a very local level. Sustainable CT is an organization helping them do that by incentivizing them and getting directly involved in town politics. Here's Executive Director Lynn Stoddard.
We work at the elected official level to engage them in the program and pass a council resolution to say we care about these issues, we want our community to be thriving and inclusive and resilient. That's pretty easy. Once they're in, we have all kinds of resources, outreach, materials to help towns take action. So how that looks is we have a menu of 55 main actions that span from arts and cultural activities to thriving local economies, buying local foods, tapping into your local economies and supporting them, to traditional environmental things like renewable energy, energy efficiency, recycling and materials management. And in a town, there are usually multiple committees dealing with these things, an ag committee, an economic development committee. What we've heard from our local officials is this platform is so comprehensive and broad that there's a place for all these committees of volunteers in towns. And not only is there a place, but there's a unifying place to create kind of a coordinating effect for their towns. Now we can kind of integrate those silos. And it's been kind of an unexpected outcome of the program for us to hear that feedback from towns that this is indeed a way to bring these different players together in engaging in their communities.
Those communities need help, too. Jay Williams, president of the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving, is a former Obama administration official who's now heading up one of the largest grant-making organizations in the state of Connecticut.
As a foundation that represents and serves 29 communities in the greater Hartford area, communities that are as diverse as a large urban center with a very diverse population that is struggling with economics and housing and all sorts of issues, to smaller communities that are much more homogeneous, that have a concentration of wealth. There are a lot of things that divide those communities, demographics, socioeconomics, the conditions of schools, the conditions of neighborhood. But one thing that we've seen with increasing frequency that does unite those communities and is getting people to talk to one another are the issues around climate change. We spent the past 10 months, my staff and I, going to each and every one of those communities on what we're calling a listening tour, and really having a conversation of how we can be a more potent and valuable partner with them as they aspire to advance their communities. And while we have heard a lot of unique things in those communities about some of their frustrations or some of their aspirations, a common thread amongst those have been the concerns about the preservation of their natural resources, the protection about the environmental impacts. And what we've been able to get a consensus on is that the borders of a wealthy community and the neighborhoods and the great school systems have nothing to do, have no bearing on the watershed or the air quality or the other natural resources that traverse those boundaries, traverse those lines on a map that are so often used in too many cases to divide ourselves. So we have seen this crisis as an opportunity to convene people around a discussion that also begins to introduce some solutions.
Bill, I'm wondering if you can pick up on this idea, though, of banding people together, including some who might be at cross purposes in other walks of life. The folks here at Yale have done an amazing job in another department charting the Americans' view of climate change and just how many people over the years think of climate as an important issue, something they would vote on. How many people believe that climate change is actually human-made. But because of these differences, it's sometimes hard to do anything other than get a group of 200 like-minded people together and all kind of nod our heads. How do you do that?
Let me give you some good news. The rate at which people are beginning to understand, I think, is reflected on this panel, the rate at which people are beginning to understand and come together. So, for instance, in the last year and a half, nigh on 100 big cities around the country have adopted a pledge to go to 100% renewable energy. The first ones were Berkeley and Madison, just as you would expect. Now it's Atlanta, now it's Salt Lake City, now it's San Diego. When President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords in his Rose Garden speech, he said, "I was elected to be president for Pittsburgh, not Paris." 2 hours later, the mayor of Pittsburgh said, "Thank you very much. We're going 100% renewable by 2040. So that's a very good sign. And one of the things it reflects is that though the oil industry did a terrific job of sowing dissent about the idea of climate change, their strategy of obfuscation was effective, or more effective than it should have been. They've been ineffective in making people dislike renewable energy. It turns out that when you poll Americans, the thing that gets the highest ratings of anything that they poll people about is more government support for solar energy. 80% of Republicans, 80% of independents, more than 80% of Democrats say this is a top priority. Now, they do it for different reasons, I think, sometimes. I think that there are people, conservatives, who think, my home is my castle, and now I'm happy that it's, entirely self-sufficient, and I don't ever have to, depend on anyone for anything ever again. But that's okay. This is a place on which we can build very quickly, and since it's probably the most important of all the ways of preventing further climate change, that's a good start.
Here's climate economist Gary Yeo again.
bills just emphasize one of the key steps, expanding the participation of municipalities and cities and individuals taking on individual pledges to make their own contributions to meeting the Paris Accords. States are undertaking that, and I think that 7 years ago, National Academy of Sciences put out a report called America's Climate Choices. It had five panels. One was the overarching committee. The executive summary went for 100 pages, but there were five pages of recommendations. The first three of which was reduce emissions as quickly as possible. The economists on the committee wanted to write that as price carbon, price carbon, price carbon. Sort of got away from that, but it strikes me that even in the absence of leadership in Washington, a good deal of mitigation activity is underway. Not sufficient, probably, but underway, and it needs to accelerate, but it is indeed underway. Second one was adaptation, and to think about making investments that don't guarantee that the harm isn't going to happen, but reduce the likelihood that the harm is going to happen. Bill's right, you're never going to be able to invest in adaptations that generate a complete guarantee that the flood won't happen. That's just not going to happen. So you need to be able to prepare for the bad news, but ameliorate the relative risks. The third recommendation, and this is the one that worries me, that's slowing down the timeline, getting back to your question, was supporting research at the federal level in pure science and technology, in the economics of market penetration, in the economics of dispersing across developing countries so countries don't have to go through the same historical sequences as the developed world has now, that they can leapfrog into the new technologies. The federal government has pulled away from that, and that is, I'm afraid, a situation where there is enormous damage being done.
That's Wesleyan University's Gary Yeo. More of my conversation with him and our other panelists in just a minute. But I wanted to play a bit of an interview with Philip Warburg, the former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and a senior fellow at Boston University's Institute for Sustainable Energy. He's been writing about how states have been moving ahead with new renewable energy technologies, even with little support from the federal government, and in some cases, in states where you might not think the political landscape is easy to navigate. His example, Kansas, a red state that he says could teach our region a thing or two about wind power.
Kansas is a very pragmatic, very conservative state where you wouldn't necessarily think renewable energy was taking off. But in fact, it's really one of the leaders in the nation. 36% of its total power generation comes from wind. And that's not because they have some deep abiding concern about climate change. It's because they see the economics of wind power as benefiting them. Individual ranchers and farmers who get an annuity from the wind turbines on their property worth much more than if that small amount of land was used for agricultural purposes. Local payments to help with various community projects, retail revenues from all of the construction workers who come through and the operational staff who stay there. And I think there's also a sense of connection between our reliance upon foreign energy sources and the wars we've been fighting in the Middle East. We live in a pretty protected bubble in many parts of New England where not that many people go off to fight wars in the Middle East, but in places like Kansas, that's not the case. And one economic development chief said to me, either we have to put wind turbines on our prairie or we have to bury our children beneath our prairie. So that's a fairly stark perspective on one aspect of renewable energy's benefits to Kansas.
And it sounds as though the argument is being made that energy independence that you can do in a homegrown way is something that Kansas can do by harnessing the wind, but it's not that dissimilar from the same argument for drilling for oil in Oklahoma or drilling for natural gas in Pennsylvania or Colorado. It's the same type of argument being made.
Yeah, I don't think there's some higher set of values attached to wind relative to those fossil fuels. And in fact, those fossil fuels, as you say, are being developed aggressively in places like Oklahoma and actually in Kansas as well. One added benefit that this rural county in Kansas where I did a lot of my research for my wind book developed was a wind technology training program at the community college. It started in about 2007 with some 5 students. Today, it's got 150 students, and they find jobs immediately on graduating from their 2-year certificate program. In fact, they've expanded now to include solar technology, so it's been renamed a renewable energy technology program. Again, not something you'd necessarily expect at a community college in the middle of Kansas farm country, but in fact, it provides local employment for a lot of people, including the children of farmers who can't find gainful employment on the farm. And it's really seen as a huge economic boon.
One of the reasons why they're able to get 36% of their power from wind is because, well, Kansas is a windy place. Just how much windier is it than say, Massachusetts?
Well, it really is in what's often called the Wind Belt, which extends from Texas on up through the Dakotas. And in virtually all of those states, you see elevated levels of commitment to wind power because the wind resource is so prodigious. Much more so than on land, for example, in Massachusetts. I think that is one of the constraints that we face here. There is better wind in parts of Maine on land, in New Hampshire on land, not so much in Connecticut or Rhode Island. And we're beginning to develop those, although there's a lot greater concern about viewshed protection, noise issues, et cetera, in our more densely settled region than there is in wide open spaces in places like Kansas or the Dakotas. One of the great advantages of offshore wind for New Englanders and for people in the Northeast is that offshore wind is every bit as strong as the wind that you find blowing through the Great Plains. It happens to be very close to major metropolitan centers, so if we can tap that offshore wind, we will be both providing a great new renewable energy resource without creating the kinds of resistance that we experienced here in New England and specifically in Massachusetts to the first proposed offshore wind farm, Cape Wind, in Nantucket Sound.
So much like in the experience of Kansas, if the market itself can shift in a way so that this is more competitive, it's less expensive, and it can be something that will compete with dirtier burning types of fuel, all of a sudden now we may see more and more development. But there's always going to be a cap here in the Northeast, isn't there, Philip? I mean, there's always going to be only so much land or even offshore land that we can harvest the wind on.
Well, if you actually take offshore into account, I'm not sure that limit is so clear. Mm. And if you combine various forms of renewable energy, we're really looking at a transformative moment, I think, in our overall electricity economy. Vermont has set its renewable portfolio standard as providing a minimum of 75% of all electric generation from renewables by 2032. So that's a pretty ambitious standard. And Massachusetts, actually, the legislature just in July has adopted a new standard that would get us to 50% reliance on renewable technology by 2045. So will we be getting all of our electricity from renewables by the middle of this century? Very likely not. Could we be getting half of our electricity from some combination of wind, solar, biomass, geothermal, small-scale hydro? Absolutely.
But what about Massachusetts' big investment in hydro coming from Quebec? The fact is a lot of environmentalists, people who want to see more renewable development in and around Massachusetts and across the New England region, look at the plans to bring down hydropower from Hydro-Quebec through the state of Maine as something that diverts our attention from making the types of investment in homegrown renewables that might get us to that point that you're describing.
Well, I think that's true. I think that there is competition between different sources of renewable energy. We can't think about unitary solutions. I think one of the mistakes that we allowed ourselves during the 20th century was to focus on a very small number of very problematic technologies, such as coal, such as nuclear. And once you build those technologies, you develop expertise in those technologies as well as an economic investment. And it makes it harder and harder to diversify. But I think what we really need to do is look at a highly diversified energy economy that doesn't just talk about the generation of power, but it talks about the wise use of power and the integration of storage. And that's one area where hydro actually has a significant role to play. Pumped storage is a means of capturing, for example, surplus wind power when it's generated or surplus solar power when it's generated, and releasing that power at the appropriate times when there's demand that exceeds the supply of electricity. So I think we just have to stop thinking about electricity generation as a means of producing lots of electrons. It's a lot more complicated than that, but it can be a lot more environmentally sustainable than that.
With all of the reporting that you've done, the places that you've traveled, both looking at wind and solar power outside of this region, what are the things that you think we can really take away at the level of public policy or maybe even mindset that perhaps get in our way when we're trying to figure out how to make renewables even more part of the mix in New England?
Well, I think if we took a longer historical view of the New England landscape, and I mean that quite literally, we might be more forgiving of the introduction of technologies like wind and solar. If you look at New England's landscape during the 19th century, it was largely a farmed landscape. We now have reforested New England because farming just doesn't make that much economic sense on a large scale in New England, and we can't compete with places like Kansas. So we're very attached to thinking of New England as pristine forests when in fact they're not pristine forests. So we don't want to compromise that visual beauty for the sake of renewable energy. I think we have to think in a more expansive way about what it means to integrate renewables into our landscape. So it might mean more wind turbines, for example, in the Berkshire Mountains or in the White Mountains or in parts of Maine. And I think that we also can learn from Kansas in looking off our shore and saying, well, actually, we can develop wind power on a very large, you could say, industrial scale without creating the kinds of reactions that we got from vacationers on the Cape and in Martha's Vineyard to the Cape Wind Project. If we are able to build large-scale wind that does not interfere with our viewshed issues and that does not create problems in terms of fisheries and the like, I think we can see an equivalency in terms of what is happening in places like Kansas.
That's Philip Warburg, former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and senior fellow at Boston University's Institute for Sustainable Energy. You're listening to Climate Game Changers, a special from NEXT and the Nature Conservancy. When we come back, how are cities adapting to rising seas? And what happens when the climate displaces a large number of Americans? Stay with us. I'm John Dankosky. This is Climate Game Changers, a special from NEXT and the Nature Conservancy. In September, I moderated a panel discussion at Yale with author and environmental activist Bill McKibben, Lynn Stoddard, executive director of Sustainable CT, and Jay Williams, president of the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving. Also on our panel was Gary Yeo, economics professor at Wesleyan University and a member of the 2007 Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We've been talking about adaptation to climate change and ways to try and stop it through the adoption of renewable energy technologies. But Gary Yeo talked about another problem, how bigger storms threaten our cities. I asked him what we can expect.
An increased frequency and in intense precipitation events and coastal flooding that's a nuisance now will become more and more dramatic. Even regular nor'easters will begin to carry storm surge with them. The spin of the storm piles water into Long Island Sound at an increasing rate. Large storms will show up much more frequently. When extreme weather events happen in Connecticut in December or January, notwithstanding Senator Inhofe, snow is not a sign that the climate isn't warming. It's just a manifestation of that's what precipitation looks like in the wintertime. And so large storm events in the wintertime cause different sorts of problems. They don't cause the flooding problems necessarily. It melts perhaps slowly, but it causes ice dams on your roof and damages that way. Water comes in from your house that way. Notwithstanding the increased precipitation frequency, Connecticut is vulnerable to drought. And when we're in a period of drought, the ground hardens. So when a big weather event comes and a lot of rain happens, it just washes into the Connecticut River and goes away. It doesn't sit there and help anything.
That's Gary Yeo from Wesleyan University. Jay Williams also served as a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Commerce and Economic Development and Deputy Director of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs in the Obama administration. I asked Williams about the role and challenge for the federal government in tackling issues of climate change. We were then joined on stage by Lynn Stoddard of Sustainable CT.
During the time when I was in administration and Superstorm Sandy was upon us, and we were working with local officials to first and foremost preserve and protect life and the well-being. So that's the immediate issue. But then there's an inclination then to immediately start talking about rebuilding. And that's it's a tough momentum to get in front of, because after you've made sure to the extent you can preserve life, protect life, and all those things which are the priority, the local officials, and I was formerly a local official, want to say, okay, how do we rebuild? How do we make it just the way it was before the storm hit? And the reality that Bill talked about, that as amazing as engineering advancements as we have, we will never out-engineer Mother Nature. We will never out-engineer the effects of climate change. And there has not been a tendency of the federal government to bring to bear a very difficult conversation that we cannot continue to pour billions of dollars in to the very same places that were just devastated by the most recent unprecedented event. And each event is unprecedented until it's not. And think that we're going to somehow come up with a different conclusion.
Do you walk, Lynn, with municipal officials through a flood, and do they get it? Do they see the way that I built this community maybe isn't the way that we need to rebuild the community?
I mean, I think they clearly are. Nature is teaching them right now and walking them through this exercise with maps and whatnot. They may not start building the floodgates like New York City is, but when they're putting dollars into repairing that road, they're realizing it's now getting flooded often. We may need to reroute traffic or change the engineering of that project, or think differently about how our community, how people get around in our community.
That's Lynn Stoddard of Sustainable CT from our Climate Game Changers panel discussion. Earlier this year, I talked about many of these issues with Dr. Atiya Martin. She served as the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Boston. Currently, she's CEO and founder of All Aces, Inc. I asked her right off the bat how the city's adapting to rising sea levels.
There's a number of strategies happening that involve the government, the private sector, as well as nonprofits and the philanthropic world. And so there's a number of initiatives that are more research-based, that are trying to understand at a more nuanced level how sea level rise is going to impact Boston. The other types of approaches are more practical and more on the traditional ways people think about resilience, and that's buildings and infrastructure, and thinking about how do we develop infrastructure that can withstand the impacts of sea level rise. And that includes the work with private sector partners as they're developing on areas of the city that are potentially threatened by, or not potentially, but are definitely threatened by sea level rise in the Seaport area. And so there's some creative ideas around living with water as opposed to trying to fight it, and an understanding that we tend to lose that battle, as well as things that are happening more on the socioeconomic level and understanding how the disparate impacts of climate change, including sea level rise, but also including the urban heat island effect and other impacts that also disproportionately impact vulnerable populations, which include low to no income communities, people of color, and areas with high concentrations of people with disabilities.
Can you give us some specifics about that threat to people of lower socioeconomic means, some of the more people who are already facing struggles in and around the city of Boston, what rising sea levels might mean to them specifically?
Absolutely. So rising sea level is an interesting issue that we tend to only focus on the direct impacts, meaning the areas that are visibly going to be impacted, downtown Boston, Seaport area, East Boston. But we forget that there's a number of riverine systems in the city of Boston that also get flooded that reach into poor communities and more working class communities, as well as the intersection between people who are living in poverty and working class and race. And so there's that piece of it. But then there's also sometimes we forget that climate change is actually more than sea level rise. And I kind of hinted at it before that the urban heat island effect, as well as the fact that we get flooded from rainfall, as well as the impacts of sea level rise in causing other types of flooding. What that really means is that what we see is the outcome of those impacts on communities who are most vulnerable looks very much like the struggles they face in day-to-day life. What we've learned from emergencies, including those from climate change, is that the people who struggle the most in day-to-day life are the people who struggle the most when we face emergencies and disasters, whether from climate change or other types of emergencies. And so this idea of how do we make sure that as we're making these investments in addressing sea level rise, that we are embedding within the way we understand risk. And usually when we talk about risk, we're talking about the loss, the potential loss that we could suffer based on the combination of threats and hazards, in this case, climate change, as well as the types of vulnerabilities we face. So the infrastructure vulnerabilities, the environmental vulnerabilities, economic, what we oftentimes don't include in that risk analysis and the vulnerability is social vulnerability or people, and how by including that in our understanding of risk, we actually are forced to develop mitigative strategies that support all the types of vulnerabilities that we face. Because ultimately, we are still going to experience the consequences of social vulnerability. We just won't have and made the investments to address the issues.
What's some advice that you have for other cities and towns around New England that might look at your work in Boston in resilience and adaptation and try to take some lessons?
Well, I'll start with something I've mentioned, which is risk analysis. So when we're looking at the potential loss we could face, especially from climate change and sea level rise, that we are including that social vulnerability in there, not just because it makes sure that we develop strategies, but it also ensures that the investments happen and that we're monitoring the long-term impacts of those investments. The other big piece is looking at non-traditional partnerships with the private sector, with communities in particular, especially communities, to be able not just to problem solve through these issues, but also look at creative ways to invest in being able to mitigate the impacts of climate change. And I'd say the third key one is really looking at how do we make sure that we're embedding equity into all aspects of the work that we're doing, with the reality that when we are trying to work through these issues, it is very easy to do status quo things that can actually perpetuate inequities and make them worse. And so making sure that we are understanding the demographics of our areas, having the most marginalized communities, ensuring they're part of the conversation, and making sure that there's accountability in terms of how we're collecting data, how we understand the approaches that we're taking, and looking at the multiple benefits from the work that we're doing. For example, if we are making investments in infrastructure projects, how do we make sure that as we're doing those infrastructure projects, we're looking at equity in how we're doing contracts for those projects and making sure that women-owned businesses and minority-owned businesses and all of the different types of marginalized groups get access to those opportunities, which they're usually locked out of. And so getting creative and looking across silos to be able to really increase the effectiveness and impact of the share challenge that we're all facing. Government can't do it alone. And so we have to be collaboratively working together in order to address these issues. They're big challenges, but you have to break them down into smaller pieces and tackle them. There's limited funding at the local level, which many cities and towns are struggling with. And I think that reinforces the importance of the types of collaborative partnerships that we need across the private sector, as well as with academia and philanthropy.
That's Dr. Atiyah Martin. She served as the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Boston. Cities facing climate change don't just have to worry about the impact on those currently living there. What if a big climate-related event forced thousands of people to flee and they landed right in your city? That's what happened to Hartford, Connecticut after Hurricane Maria devastated the island of Puerto Rico. Here's Jay Williams again from the Hartford Foundation.
When that event happened, and understanding that the Hartford area has a significantly one of the highest concentrations of connections to Puerto Rico than any other area across the country. So when that event happened and there was a significant influx of individuals, climate refugees, coming to the Hartford area, there weren't a lot of tools and there wasn't a lot of understanding and it was not a lot of data to understand what the implications were for integrating and supporting those individuals as they arrived. So we worked with University of Connecticut and Hunter College to commission a study that would help us understand that, to begin to help us and our donors how to respond, but also then very much sharing that information with all stakeholders. And it was interesting that as the respondents completed the survey, we found that there were significant concerns, not surprisingly, but we were able to begin to pinpoint some of those concerns around housing, around food security, around education, and around some things that we might take for granted when we live here in an area that has four very distinct climates. When those individuals and their children were relocating, we think about getting them into school. Okay, well, we check that box. But not understanding that come September, October, November, the climate here is very much different than the climate it is clearly in Puerto Rico. So even things like that, the understanding of how to make sure that those families and those children had the appropriate attire for our fall and winter season. So it was a lesson for us that here we sat in the greater Hartford area where that event didn't directly impact us, but it impacted us in a way when it affected our brothers and sisters and fellow citizens in a U.S. territory and found themselves relocating here. It was at our front door in ways that we perhaps never really would have imagined, and at a rate that we probably never would have imagined. So it is, we're affected, whether it's the climate effects are here directly, as they often are, or somewhere else that touches us.
That's Jay Williams of the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving, speaking at Yale's Kroon Hall as part of a discussion called Climate Game Changers. I'm John Dankosky. When we come back, our panelists answer some big global questions about climate change from the audience. Stay with us. I'm John Dankosky. This is Climate Game Changers, a special from NEXT and the Nature Conservancy. In September, I sat down with academics, experts, and community leaders to talk about the impact of climate change. We talked at Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Our panelists, climate activist Bill McKibben and Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Yeo, took questions from the audience.
Ryan Shelby from West Hartford. Kind of a dark question for Bill, but... let's take it outside of North America for a second to areas that are extremely affected by climate change. Climate refugees and the millions in Bangladesh. You mentioned the Maldives, Tuvalu, et cetera. In your opinion, do you see a rise in, infrastructural ecoterrorism or any violence from places that really had very little at first, but now have nothing left, and they kind of want to, fight
I doubt
back?
It. I doubt it. I hope not. I mean, one of the things that's really been wonderful to watch is the willingness of people in places that cause none of this problem to collaborate with people around the world in building big nonviolent movements. And it's been really, that's what I spend much of my time doing now, and more all the time, off around the world. I've been just was off in Africa doing a lot of work. And I do think what's going to happen, and I think we already see it, and Gary and Jay were alluding to it, is an enormous amount of instability that comes from the sheer fact of people having no choice but to leave their homes. So Syria is the perfect example. There were obviously several causes of the Syrian civil war, but the academics are pretty clear that, if not the biggest, close to it, was the fact that we had the deepest drought in the history of what we used to call the Fertile Crescent, you know, and when it came, it drove a million or more Syrian farmers off their land and into the cities. In the course of a year or two, Syria was already stressed, and it could not accommodate that kind of influx and economic upheaval. And we've seen what happened when a million people left Syria. It was enough to fracture the politics of Europe and, to some degree, the politics of the United States. The sort of just mainline consensus prediction is that by the middle of the century, there will be 140 or 150 million refugees out of that part of the world, North Africa, the Middle East, alone, okay, and worldwide multiples of that, because people will simply have no choice. It's literally becoming, in large parts of that belt stretching sort of through India, Pakistan, the Middle East, it's becoming too hot for significant periods of the year for people to really exist. I mean, we've set new temperature records the last 3 years. We've had days and several days in a row when the temperature is 128, 129 degrees, okay? It's barely possible for human beings to survive in that kind of temperature for any period of time. And every computer projection shows that that area expands and the number of days go up. So we're going to have to figure out as a world of all the climate adaptation challenges, the single biggest one is going to be figuring out how to deal with the fact that people are going to be on the move around the world. And it's very clear at the moment that we're not in any way physically, psychologically, politically, ideologically, economically prepared to deal with that. And we better be. Quite aside from the moral perversity of the country that produced more carbon than any other country in the world and refusing to deal with the Paris Climate Accords, and B, deciding that it's no longer going to accept refugees or immigrants to the country. Quite aside from the moral perversity of it, it's just not going to work. I mean, it's people, when they have to leave, will leave and go somewhere else, and we better figure that out.
Hi, I want to go to a question on this side. We've got a question right back here.
Adele Taylor from Woodbury, Connecticut. In a world of limited resources and a population that is increasing at an accelerating speed, do any of you have any, this is rather a big question, a big problem, but do any of you have any suggestions or thoughts on what to do about what I would say is global overpopulation and its increasing demands on resources?
So you saved the easiest question for last. Gary Yeo, I knew you'd appreciate that, but it is a big important question.
Oh, it certainly is. There are places in the world where population growth is slowing, and those are the developed countries. But elsewhere around the world, you were exactly right. An increased demand for increasingly scarce resources is going to create problems, going to create refugee problems, going to create problems in borders. So I'm just articulating the problem.
Gary, let me jump in here, because I've actually done some work over the years on this, and I think it's one of the places that allows us to think, to really talk about some good news. You know, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, the average woman on this planet had 6 children. That number is now 2.3 and continuing to fall. It's been the biggest demographic change we've ever seen. Biggest, in some ways, biggest change. And the reason that it happened was because people in developing countries in particular figured out what the crucial thing to do was. Any place that we educated and empowered women to any degree, fertility rates, because it just turned out that given a choice, most people didn't want to have 6 kids, okay? And that's been remarkable. The population of the Earth, 7 point some billion now, it's going to go up to about 9.5 billion before it tops out in mid-century and plateaus and then goes down. A planet that struggles with 7 billion, it won't be easier with 9 billion, but we're not going to prevent most of that change. It's just built into this kind of demographic bulge moving through the population. And in terms of climate change, it's not the problem. We forget how big the gulf is in consumption. I was in Tanzania last year doing some reporting for The New Yorker on renewable energy. The average American family uses more energy between the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve and dinner on January 2nd than the average Tanzanian family uses in a year, okay? So in terms of climate change, the number of Tanzanians is a rounding error. It isn't the problem. The problem is dramatically increased consumption in places with relatively stable populations, think China, which are beginning to consume like Americans. It's not clear that the planet can deal with one continent that consumes like North Americans. It's completely clear it can't deal with everybody living the way you do. It's also clear that everyone's going to try to live the way we do as long as we keep doing it. So bending that consumption curve in the same way that we bent the curve of fertility is really important. We don't know quite what the thing is that equates to women's education, though probably it has something to do with prices on carbon and so on and so forth that would really help. But that's where the challenge is. But it allows us, I'm glad you asked the question, because it really allows us to think positively about how quickly humans can make really important changes. You would think that fertility population would be more biologically hardwired in some Darwinian fashion even than consumption, but it turns out it's not. Human beings rose to this challenge, and it's been a very remarkable thing to see. So for those who helped in that work, and I'm sure that there were plenty of people here who contributed whatever to the groups and things that helped figure out some of this puzzle, many thanks. Most of the thanks goes to people in developing nations who did this work, figured it out, and made it happen. And it's one of the things that gives me hope going forward.
That's Bill McKibben, author and environmental activist. He's founder of 350.org. He joined a Climate Game Changers Symposium with Lynn Stoddard, Executive Director of Sustainable CT, Gary Yeo, economics professor at Wesleyan University, and Jay Williams, president of the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving. This event was held in partnership with the Nature Conservancy and took place at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Thanks to Ed Whitaker, Beth Messina, Lily Tyson, and Katie Tolarski. For more climate and clean energy news, go to our website, nextnewengland.org. Thank you.